Boris Johnson throws British politics into turmoil. He suspended Parliament. The Prime Minister committed a constitutional outrage. That's this lawmaker's take.
Let me put it to you that your president in America wanted to do something that he did not have a mandate for, that there was no majority in Congress for, and he simply abolished Congress.
Boris Johnson has his defenders, though. Members of Parliament pushing for Brexit say, just get on with it. I'm Carol Hills. We've got the UK Parliament covered today on The World. Also, after 18 years of war in Afghanistan, the US and Taliban are closing in on a peace deal.
It's been a long and complicated process. Sometimes these negotiations go on well into the night.
And an old Chinese rebel base attracts a new generation of tourists. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Prime Minister Boris Johnson had a surprise for British politics today. He asked the Queen to suspend Parliament for 5 weeks, starting September 10th. That's a big deal because the UK is hurtling toward an October 31st deadline on Brexit. But Johnson said today there's ample time for Parliament to work things out.
Ample time in Parliament for MPs to debate the EU, to debate Brexit and all the other issues. Ample time.
After the Queen approved Johnson's call to suspend Parliament, what followed was a whole lot of outrage. It came from the opposition, from political pundits, the public, and members of Johnson's own Conservative Party.
It's absolutely outrageous.
A smash and grab on our democracy.
Typical Boris Johnson nonsense.
What did he say? As a child, he wanted to be world king. But he's making a damn good start.
It's dictatorship.
A constitutional outrage.
A constitutional crisis. Beyond outrageous.
It's just not right.
And I will not have it.
We'll hear from both sides. Joining us first today is Pauline Latham, a member of Parliament from the Conservative Party and a supporter of Boris Johnson. She says the Prime Minister's move is not as drastic as critics are saying.
It isn't technically suspending it for 5 weeks because we weren't going to be there for almost 4 weeks anyway. We're going back next Tuesday for 2 weeks and then we take the conference season. During the prorogation, all that happens is we don't sit in Parliament.
But isn't Parliament where the discussion needs to be and where the work needs to be taking place around Brexit, this major, major issue?
Yes, but until Boris Johnson comes back with either a new deal or no deal, there isn't really anything further to discuss. We have discussed it dozens of days over the last 3 years. We've discussed it again and again and again.
You sound very calm about all this, but today the value of the British pound fell after the news was announced. Do you worry what all of this is doing to British business and the UK economy?
Of course, fluctuations in currency are never good. I mean, it'll be good for exports, but it isn't going to be good overall for the country. And the sooner we can give certainty to the country, which will be the 31st of October, whatever, whether it's a deal or no deal, then I think that things will stabilise.
A lot of the upset today about this announcement is that it's dragging the Queen into this mess. And many people see that as unseemly.
It isn't really dragging the Queen into it because he has asked for a prorogation of Parliament so that she can present the Queen's speech, which she does regularly. This is the longest period of time we've gone without a Queen's speech. And it is time we had a new direction in Parliament because we've got a new Prime Minister.
Now, there was a snap poll this afternoon in Britain by YouGov, and it says only 27% of British people back the suspension of Parliament. 47% said they oppose it. That's not really going in your favour, is it?
No, I understand that. But probably it wasn't explained that we were only actually having 3 or 4 extra days from when we wouldn't have been sitting anyway. The trouble is the media have been irresponsible and whipped up animation amongst the people who are worried. Of course they're worried because they're not being given the whole story.
Well, it's not only the media that's getting whipped up. A lot of members of Parliament are pretty whipped up. I mean, members of your own party.
They're not people who want to leave the European Union. They've been trying to thwart Parliament all the way to stop us leaving the EU, which is something that the country voted. We had 17.4 million people voted to say they wanted to leave the European Union. And we promised that we would deliver that.
Well, there's also been a lot of questions about that referendum itself, low turnout, possible influence of the Russians. There's a lot of questions about the validity of the referendum in terms of it, of what it really means and what Britons really intended when they voted for it.
I mean, was the biggest poll ever. We have never had so many people vote before in anything. I know people say, well, they didn't know what they were voting for. I think that's being really condescending to the people who voted. The people I talk to are saying they knew exactly what they voted for. And if we have to leave without a deal, so be it. Let's just do it.
There's a ton of harumphing going around in Parliament. Do you think there will be a vote of no confidence in your government?
There might be, but I don't think at the moment Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition, has the numbers to win that vote. I think there'll be enough people will think very hard before they vote against the government. I mean, we are in a difficult situation because we don't have a majority in the House of Commons now, and maybe it is time for a general election.
Pauline Latham is a Conservative Member of Parliament, voicing her support for Prime Minister Boris Johnson today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Bradshaw has a very different point of view. In a tweet this morning, he said Johnson's move to prorogue Parliament is, quote, a coup, plain and simple, against our parliamentary democracy. Bradshaw is a member of Parliament for the opposition Labour Party. Ben, the Queen has said it's happening, the proroguing of Parliament. Is the coup over?
No, it's not. And the Prime Minister has put the Queen in an absolutely impossible position, and it's shameful that he has done so, dragging our monarch into the most serious constitutional crisis this country has ever known in peacetime. But I'm confident that Parliament will rescue her from that next week. There's a very significant majority in our House of Commons that oppose no deal, a growing number of Conservative legislators, members of Mr. Johnson's own party, say they will do whatever it takes to prevent us crashing out with no deal. And I'm confident that Parliament will find a way to stop Mr. Johnson committing this constitutional outrage.
Why do you see this move by Boris Johnson as unconstitutional?
Because we live in a parliamentary democracy in this country. Let me put it to you that your president in America wanted to do something that he did not have a mandate for, that there was no majority in Congress for, and he simply abolished Congress and put it through by diktat. That is, in effect, what Mr. Johnson is proposing to do here. Under our constitution, unwritten as it may be, we are a parliamentary democracy. Our parliament is sovereign, not a prime minister, and especially not a prime minister who has no mandate. He hasn't been elected by anybody, and he's trying to do something which all of the opinion polls show has overwhelming opposition among the public in Great Britain.
But since, as you say, the UK doesn't have a written constitution, how can you be so sure this is unconstitutional?
Well, that puts us in a very difficult position. I happen to be somebody who favours us having a written constitution, but we don't. But in the end, our parliament is sovereign in this country, and I think you will find next week our parliamentarians in the House of Commons are taking control of the situation and doing what we need to do to prevent this absolutely outrageous catastrophe happening to our country.
But what can you do? I mean, wouldn't you be defying the Queen at this point?
No, the Queen would not get involved in anything like
that. But
like
she's that. Already and involved because she's assented to it.
She has to assent to a prorogation on the request of the Prime Minister. But there are a number of measures that Parliament can take to prevent this happening. We can, for example, pass laws. We can, for example, pass a vote of no confidence, voting Boris Johnson out of power and install a different Prime Minister. So we have a number of weapons in our armoury, and I'm absolutely confident that in the end, democracy will prevail, because if it doesn't, the United Kingdom is facing a very, very dark period in our history indeed, absolutely unprecedented for a Prime Minister. This hasn't happened since the Tudor monarchs in the 1500s, which historians in America, I think, will be well aware of.
But in 1997, Prime Minister John Major prorogued Parliament to avoid debate over a scandal that was breaking. What's so different this time?
Firstly, it wasn't for nearly so long. Boris Johnson is recommending proroguing Parliament for 5 weeks, which is unprecedented. But secondly, we weren't facing the single biggest issue this country has faced in peacetime in modern centuries. That is Boris Johnson's determination to take the United Kingdom out of the European Union without a deal, with all of the devastating consequences that would bring to our economy, to peace in Northern Ireland, and it would lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom. And he's doing so while trying to avoid any degree of parliamentary scrutiny, which all governments have to be subjected to, or votes or approval by Parliament or the people. Incredible, and it must and it will be stopped.
But what brought us to this point is that Brexiteers say it's undemocratic to oppose Brexit. The people voted in a referendum. They see any effort at slowing down Brexit or sabotaging it as undemocratic. Johnson's trying to enforce the will of the people. That's what a Brexiteer would say. How do you respond?
We had a very narrow win for the Leave campaign more than 3 years ago in that referendum. Nobody in that campaign mentioned the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. The Leave campaign was premised on the fact that we would get a deal with the European Union and we would withdraw in an orderly way. The people, including the many Conservative legislators who are outraged by this, are not opposing Brexit. What they are opposing is Boris Johnson enforcing a crash out over the edge of a cliff, no deal Brexit on the British people with no mandate from the people and no mandate from Parliament. As I say, I think we will stop it and it must be stopped.
That's Labour Party MP Ben Bradshaw. America has been at war in Afghanistan for 18 years, but the U.S. and the Taliban might be close to a peace deal. The two sides started negotiations last year. Diplomats have been meeting face-to-face in Doha, Qatar, in the Persian Gulf. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following this story, and she's here in the studio. Shirin, what do we know?
So this is the ninth time that the American negotiators are meeting with the Taliban. In the past 7 days, U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been sitting down with the Taliban officials to figure out if they can agree on the details of this deal. Now, it's been a long and complicated process. Sometimes these negotiations go on well into the night, and reporters have been camping outside the venue where these talks take place, and they've been waiting to hear the latest news.
So how close are they to a deal?
Well, today we know that the Taliban and the U.S. have finalized the text for a peace agreement. And there are three versions of this text. One is in English and the other one is in Dari and there's one in Pashto. These are the main languages that are spoken in Afghanistan. And what the two sides are doing now is that they're making sure that the translation of these texts match up and is accurate.
That's amazing. I mean, it's not something you'd think of, but of course it matters incredibly to the people of Afghanistan.
Absolutely. The details in this text is crucial.
So what do we know at this point about what's in this deal?
We don't know the exact details of the deal yet because it hasn't been made public. But we have a sense of the main topics that they've been discussing. For example, one point that's been discussed is how and when the U.S. withdraws its troops from Afghanistan. Right now, there are about 14,000 American service members in Afghanistan, and the Taliban has been insisting that all of them leave the country as part of this deal. But now it looks like the U.S. will keep some of its troops in Afghanistan for a while, and then it will pull them out in phases over a period of 1 or 2 years.
So what happens after the U.S. and the Taliban finally come up with an agreement that they sign off on?
After the U.S. and Taliban make the announcement, which, by the way, could happen very soon, then there is going to be more negotiations. This time it's going to be between the Taliban and the Afghan government. The Afghan government hasn't been involved in these negotiations because the Taliban doesn't see them as a legitimate power in Afghanistan. So I think the next round of talks is going to be more complicated because the two sides are extremely skeptical of each other.
So if they come to a deal and sign it, will that stop the fighting?
That's definitely the hope, that the violence ends and the Taliban is integrated into the society again.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks for bringing us up to speed on this.
No problem, Carol.
French researchers say the U.S. is unnecessarily strict when it comes to rules around kidney transplants. And U.S. authorities say they might have a point. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We've all done it. It's hardly a guilty pleasure. You're staying at a hotel, and before you leave, you make sure to grab those little bottles of free shampoo, conditioner, and lotion, and you throw them in your suitcase. Is that so wrong? Well, just think about this for a second. Those little bottles add up to a lot of plastic. Marriott International, the largest hotel chain in the world, has been thinking about that. And today, Marriott announced that it would ditch those little plastic toiletry bottles starting next year. Instead, most of its hotels will have large soap and shampoo dispensers. Steve Hind is with City to Sea, a nonprofit in the UK fighting plastic pollution. He says Marriott is taking a huge step in the right direction.
This one move by this one hotel chain will save close to 500 million bottles a year going to landfill. That's close to 30% of the hotel's complete plastic use. It really shows that by taking these small decisions, large hotel chains can make a really big impact in cutting down on plastic.
Marriott is not the first hotel chain to send a public signal about being more sustainable and eco-friendly. IHG, the Intercontinental Hotels Group that owns Holiday Inn, said earlier this year that it would also ditch the tiny toiletry bottles for more than 800,000 of its hotel rooms. Steve Hind said that puts pressure on other companies to do the same. But he adds that the real solution has to go beyond the hotel and travel industries. It's about changing personal habits, even when we're on summer vacation.
We know that every year the Mediterranean in the south of Europe experiences a 40% surge in marine litter. So this is holiday goers going there and using more single-use plastic water bottles, using more takeaway containers, and of course also using these mini bottles of shampoo.
Yes, they're a nice little perk when you stay in a hotel, but Hind says it's time to let it go.
I think for many of us, when we go to hotel rooms, these mini bottles of shampoo have become a quintessential part of that quirky experience, alongside the trouser press and the shower cap. It's something that we've come to expect within our hotel rooms. But really, I think what we're saying at City to Sea is that we're having to move on at this point, and that for a really, really small impact that this is going to have on consumers, giving them refillable pump dispensers and shampoo instead of these mini bottles, this can have a really big environmental impact in cutting out all of this plastic pollution that hotels are currently responsible for.
Steve Hind is with City to Sea, a UK nonprofit that works on plastic pollution. Long waiting lists and shortages. That's the norm for people seeking kidney transplants in the United States. But here's something else surprising. A lot of donated kidneys are never used. Organs that would be used in places like France, for example, with success. This finding comes from a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Alexandre Loupy is a kidney specialist in Paris and co-author of the study.
To be honest, the story started with Dr. Rees from US who came in our unit. And during the first medical staff we had on a Monday, I was, you know, talking about a kidney transplant we performed in a 70 years old recipient who got a kidney from an 83 years old donor. And he thought it was a joke. He said, no, that's not possible. You're not doing that. And I said, yes, we are doing that. I mean, every day. This is kind of a regular situation we have. So then we realized that the practices and the use of these resource could be an answer to increasing the donor pool in the US. Then we decided to perform the study, and I was really surprised by the result.
Alexandre Loupy, what was the basic conclusion of your study?
So the conclusion of our study is that many kidneys that are recovered for transplantation and discarded, which means that they are not used for transplantation in the US, would have had a 100% chance of being used in France and provide pretty good survival.
So you're saying that in France, you're using kidneys from older donors, but they are working fine when transplanted into patients?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, it's not like a pure French system-based procedure, because Spain and the UK and also France have embarked upon doing this transplant or using the kidney from old donors 10 years ago. It's called the Old for Old program. It's basically we are giving those old kidneys to old recipients so that they can benefit from this transplant. And we can achieve pretty good survival. And also it provides patients survival benefit to the alternative, which is being maintained on dialysis.
What are the rules in the U.S. that mean that all these kidneys that you would use in France are not being used in the U.S.?
So I think it's just a matter of global policy. And, you know, in the U.S., they have a kind of scrutiny and they have this system of report cards, which are actually some disincentive, meaning that if your survival goes a little bit down, your budget can be cut down as well. So it's a very conservative system, which actually does not allow all centers to practice those transplants, which are at higher risk and provide lower performance as compared to using a young donor. But still, the performance is good. And again, as compared to being maintained on dialysis, it's giving a lot in terms of quality, quantity of life, and also cost saving for the society.
So you're saying that in the U.S., doctors are under real pressure, that if their patients who receive kidneys, their survival rate goes down overall, that there's financial implications for the doctor in terms of funding and support?
You're absolutely right. And I think this is the reason why most surgeons are reluctant to use these donors. But obviously, a simulation that we did in terms of a potentially redesigned system in the US that would apply the same rules as in France actually would have saved a huge number of life years.
Alexandre Loupy is a professor of nephrology in Paris and co-author of a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Thanks a lot, Dr. Loupy.
Thank you very much.
So what about the high number of kidneys that end up being discarded here in the U.S.? Darren Stewart is with the United Network of Organ Sharing. It's the main agency that oversees kidney distribution in the United States.
Though we're continuing to set records for organ transplants each year, the last 6 years, we've done more transplants in this country than the year before. There's still more we could do, and there is a recognized underutilization problem, in particular with respect to the older donors.
Stewart says policy changes won't happen overnight. The rules here in the U.S. are determined through an extensive process, and that involves input from patients and healthcare groups. Stewart says the priority right now is the problem of geographic disparity. The goal is to improve access to donated organs in parts of the country that currently have the biggest shortages.
If we tried to incorporate major changes to the geographic distribution of organs, as well as longevity matching, I think people's heads would explode. In theory, I would love to do that. We would all love to do that.
Stewart says it'll be at least another year before they can begin to take that on. You're listening to The World. Tropical Storm Dorian is bearing down on Puerto Rico.
I'm anxious. That's the perfect word to explain it. It's like PTSD. It's like you're stressed out. And you can see it. Everybody's stressed out because the supermarket's already empty. People are already in their houses. So it's just a stressful situation.
That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The island of Puerto Rico is facing another tropical storm. This time, its name is Dorian. Just 2 years ago, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and in many ways, people there are still recovering. The territory's still fragile infrastructure is also being tested again. Rosa Marie Palerm is a nursing student in the capital, San Juan. She was there for Maria, too. Earlier today, she told us what it was like waiting for Dorian to hit.
I'm anxious. That's the perfect word to explain it. It's like PTSD. It's like you're stressed out. And you can see it. Everybody's stressed out because the supermarket's already empty. People are already in their houses. So it's just a stressful situation.
Residents are particularly worried about the power grid. Power outages were a real problem in Puerto Rico after Maria. And in some places, regular outages continue to this day. Joining us now is Fernando Padilla. He's with Puerto Rico's state-owned utility company, PREPA. And he says officials there are handling things differently this time around.
Right now, in terms of conditions, back then, We did lack the adequate equipment. We lacked the adequate materials to become first responders. So we do have now the materials, the generators, not only of PREPA, but also the coordinations with FEMA on what exactly do we need to respond on the municipalities. In second instance, we do have the contractors available both on the local end and on mainland to respond. Third and not least, we have 33 MOUs with investor-owned utilities in the mainland. So we do have enough capacity on the material end, on the liquidity end, and also on the resource end.
Now, the islands of Vieques and Culebra, they're expected to be hit hardest by this storm. And in Vieques, it took 11 months for power to be restored after Maria. How have you prepared there for Tropical Storm Dorian?
We've prepared on various fronts. I mean, their island condition just makes it slightly challenging due to, you know, everything has to be transported either through air or through water. But one key aspect has been that we have secured the infrastructure for the undersea cable that goes from the east side of Puerto Rico heading into Vieques, and from there connects Culebra. I can also state that the hardening and the infrastructure that took place during the restoration, we do have stronger infrastructure than compared during Maria. And then in second instance, we do have generation availability generators available to quickly go and install to the municipality for a longer term. But we do have on island generators that would bring the system within hours of a direct impact.
Now, 2 years after Maria, under blue sky conditions, there are still daily power outages in some parts of Puerto Rico and weekly outages in others. Is the power infrastructure really ready for another storm?
We have a stable system, but it's still unreliable. We still have old conditions. It's still old infrastructure. And again, what happened during the restoration for Maria was basically bring up the lines slightly at the levels and old conditions it was prior to the hit. We are going to see, and we are pursuing the $2 billion appropriation from FEMA in order to begin hardening what are the critical loads and the critical areas of the island, such as hospitals, airports, water and sewage power pumps, key infrastructure for our main industries, key infrastructure for security branches of the government, and also the southeast side of Puerto Rico, where it's basically the path of 90% of the storms and hurricanes entering into land here on the island.
But of course, those things aren't going to be in place by the time this storm hits. Those are simply infrastructural things that are in process.
Correct.
Do you feel like you have enough support and assistance from the federal government in Washington in terms of money, supplies, or anything else?
Yes. I mean, we've been working very close to FEMA. They are prepared. They do have the resources and electrical equipment we would need from them, and also the coordinations for the funding once an emergency has been, as the emergency was declared by the governor and the president. So we are SSLE prepared and in partnership with FEMA and also with the U.S. Corps of Engineers.
Fernando Padilla is director of the Project Management Office for PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Greta Thunberg, the teenage environmental activist from Sweden, landed in New York City today. She's there for the United Nations Climate Summit next month. If Thunberg had flown in from Europe, her arrival wouldn't be so newsworthy. But she landed at Coney Island today in a 60-foot racing yacht, making the point that air travel is a big contributor to global warming. The 16-year-old activist sailed for 2 weeks with a small crew on the zero-emissions yacht. Thunberg posted this video a few days ago as they approached North America.
Yeah!
We're currently doing between 20 and 25 knots. Last night we hit 30 knots, and we are about 300 miles away from Nova Scotia, and it's very rough and very high waves, and yeah.
The UN Climate Summit gets underway in September. The Secretary General wants member states to come with more ambitious goals for cutting carbon emissions. Greta Thunberg has made headlines for her school strikes, protests that have inspired worldwide student demonstrations against climate change. The teenager was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year. When you're looking at healthcare in different countries, it can be hard to make comparisons. Every country has its own system, but there are some common themes. In Chile right now, they're struggling with the high costs of private health insurance. If you're a woman or if you're over 60, you have to pay 2 to 3 times more for your coverage. And if you have a pre-existing condition, like asthma, you can't get private insurance. Those are the rules. But Chile's government is debating a plan now to change that. Paige Sutherland brings us this story from Santiago.
Chile has two healthcare systems. There's the public one that anyone can access, paid for by a 7% tax on salaries. But there's also a private insurance system called ISAPRES.
Seis razones para estar en la mejor ISAPRE. ISAPRE Más Médica.
You have to pay a lot more for it, but it gives you access to specialists and better hospitals. And the waits aren't nearly as long. That's what Maria Pilar Itereta wanted.
Ella es mi amiga, que iba a venir a hacerme unas preguntas, Guadalupe.
Pilar is a lawyer in Santiago, and she has a 5-year-old daughter named Guadalupe, who was born with a cleft lip. Guadalupe needed specialty care, which she could only get through the private ISAPRES system. But when Pilar applied for private insurance, she was rejected 3 times because of her daughter's condition. Pilar says the profit-minded ISAPRES doesn't want to insure sick people.
Las ISAPRES no nos podemos dar el lujo de recibir gente enferma. O sea, las ISAPRES...
ISAPRES says they can't afford to insure sick people. It is a healthcare system, but they don't want to work with sick people. It is a win-win for them.
So Pilar, the lawyer, decided to take ISAPRES to court. She argued that healthcare is a social right, guaranteed under Chile's constitution.
Ah, no, no, no. Es que si usted está enferma y...
But ISAPRES says, no, no, no. This causes us a problem because we are looking for profit. Not to recognize your right to health. That is the hypocritical system that exists today in Chile.
It's true that ISAPRES does charge more for people who traditionally use more care. That's how insurance works. But another lawyer, Pedro Barria, who has sued ISAPRES in the past, says the private system treats people like a commodity, like a car.
When a car insurance says, I won't give you insurance if your car is dented, crashed, that's okay. But is it not okay that the health insurance tells you that I won't insure you because you have high blood pressure? This situation is different.
Apparently, the court agreed and ruled in Pilar's favor. It said that denying health care based on a pre-existing condition is discriminatory and unconstitutional. But Pilar's victory doesn't help others in her situation. That's because Chile's legal system doesn't recognize precedent. So people have to file their own lawsuits. Since the beginning of this year, more than 100,000 have sued ISAPRES, mostly over rate increases. Adriana Orozco sued to stop a 10% increase last year. But even though she won her case, Orozco says she still charged almost 3 times what her husband pays. It's unfair, she says, but feels like she has no choice.
If you had a very good public service, you could say, okay, you know, that's fine, but it's not. There is a big difference. For a public service, you can wait 6 months, a year to get surgery or an appointment with a specialist or something. But private sector, you just call and you get for the next day or for 10 days or maximum.
Like Orozco, many people who sue ISAPRES win.
ISAPRES have a big problem because obviously this is not sustainable.
Gonzalo Simón is president of the ISAPRES Association. He says ISAPRES is willing to make some concessions to put an end to these lawsuits, though in the past, it's fought any reform.
Today, we have many experts and many economists that say that this is the best way to do it. But maybe society does not want this discriminating prices. So the politicians are the ones that have to choose which system.
Under a new government proposal, people with pre-existing conditions could get private coverage. Women would pay the same rates as men, and the government would regulate rate increases, so ISAPRES wouldn't be sued as often. Some critics say that instead of tinkering with private coverage, Chile should focus on improving its public system. But for now, it's up to Congress to decide whether to approve the private reforms. If it doesn't, ISAPRES should expect the lawsuits to keep coming. For The World, Paige Sutherland, Santiago, Chile.
An explosion in a remote part of northern Russia and lots of unanswered questions. What we do know is that it happened about 3 weeks ago in Nyonexa. That's a place in the far north where the Russian government routinely tests nuclear missiles. 5 people died in the explosion, and the reports that followed were confusing. But now we have some clarity. Joshua Pollack is a nuclear expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Josh, how did the Kremlin initially respond to this explosion?
Well, they initially tried to disclose as little information as possible. There was a local report that airborne radioactivity had spiked in a nearby town. After the CTBTO, an international organization in Vienna, reported that an explosion was caught at that site by their international monitoring system. The Russian authorities, I think, were under some more pressure to disclose information, but they have been relatively closed-mouthed. And in the end, all they have said is there was a weapons development accident and these things happen. And they did compare it to a small nuclear reactor that NASA is developing. That gives us a hint about what the technology is. But by this time, it was already fairly clear what the weapon in question was.
And what was it?
Well, we don't know for sure, but all the indications are that it is a nuclear-propelled cruise missile that was unveiled by President Putin last year. This system, which is called Skyfall by NATO, is supposed to be a cruise missile of unlimited range that could fly circles around the world. As far as anyone can tell, what happened is the engine exploded.
Wasn't there also the presence of isotopes that gave some hint of what was going on?
This is an interesting story. When there's a nuclear test or a nuclear reactor accident, different radioactive isotopes have a way of getting into the air. So one of the ways that the CTBTO in Vienna detects that is with specialized detection stations located all around the world, including several in Russia. So there were reports of spikes in radioactivity, but the detection stations themselves fell silent. The Russian authorities told the CTBTO that they were experiencing some network problems. That seems a little unlikely. What I suspect was happening is that they did not want to alarm their public by keeping them informed of where this cloud of particles might be blowing in the wind. They did not want to be embarrassed by the incompetence implied by such an accident, and they did not want to disclose to the rest of the world the exact design of the reactor, since these radionuclides would provide clues to that. At least those are my suppositions.
We know Russia has a long history of stockpiling nuclear weapons. They reportedly have more than any country in the world. Is there something distinct about this weapon?
Since President Putin announced the existence of this program, the whole world has been aware of it. It is not a deployed system, as far as anyone can tell. It's very difficult to get this type of technology to work. Neither the Soviet Union nor the United States succeeded with it back in the Cold War years. This was one of almost half a dozen new nuclear delivery systems that Putin showed off to the world with the explanation that they were designed to overcome or circumvent ballistic missile defense. But now I think the risks are quite apparent, if they weren't already. I certainly hope that the Russian authorities think better of the entire program, but I don't know if that'll happen.
Joshua Pollack is a nuclear expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It's a big anniversary for China. On October 1st, the Communist Party will mark 70 years since Mao Zedong declared victory over his enemies, creating the People's Republic of China. Mao's enemies were the Chinese nationalists, backed by the U.S. They were also known as the Kuomintang, or KMT. Most of their leaders fled to the island of Taiwan, but some went into the jungles of Southeast Asia and stayed there. The world's Patrick Nguyen in Thailand recently visited and met some of the grandkids of those KMT fighters, transforming their home into a very different kind of place.
I think I've found it. Utopia. I'm on top of a mountain, looking down into a misty valley, covered in tea shrubs.
Green trees, green mountain, see the tea plantations, beautiful. It's like we are in paradise.
That's Yi. She's 31 and helps run this family tea farm. Like most people around here, she goes by a few different names. Her ID card says Yupin Chiwin Kuntong. That's a Thai name because this mountain, it's in the far north of Thailand. Or you can call her by her Chinese name, Wu Chang Yu.
Or people call me Yi.
From Yi's back porch, you can almost see Myanmar. Go another 100 miles or so northeast, you would hit China. And most people in this village, that's where they have roots. The story of how they got here has America's fingerprints all over it. It's a painful story involving the CIA and lots of opium. But try bringing all that up with the older folks up here.
They don't talk about that.
Do they still think of it as kind of a secret?
Yeah, it's a secret thing, I think.
A few doors down the road, at another tea plantation, I meet Danita Tanti Wanit, who is 35. Her grandfather, General Tuan Chi Win, was the KMT commander who brought everyone here. I ask, did your family ever tell you about the CIA stuff? Nope, she says, I had to figure it all out by myself. But the story is too good to be a secret.
Since the fall of China to the Reds, these nationalist soldiers have carried on jungle warfare against the conquerors.
It's the 1950s. Mao has won China. Most anti-communist fighters retreat to Taiwan. Those who are too far away, they scramble into Myanmar, or as it was then called, Burma. There in the wet jungle, starving, with beat-up guns. It was bad. Take it from someone who was there. That's Sombun Iemwitiakun. He's 66. And he says he was born in Myanmar, in a bunker. His dad was right-hand man to Tuan, the top commander, Danita's grandfather. Food was scarce, but Sombun says, we're tough people from the fields of southwest China. Give us a pig, he says. We'll hang it up, salt it, pepper it, dry it, eat off it for months. In a pinch, he says, they could make anything tasty. They could pull a stalk of bamboo out of the ground and make that into a meal. But what they needed were weapons to take back China from Mao. That's where the CIA comes in. The CIA comes to Myanmar, builds a runway in the jungle, starts flying in American-made guns and tons of ammo. If it weren't for America, Sombun says, there's a 50% chance we wouldn't have survived. And look, he says, I'm going to shoot you straight here. We also started trafficking opium. In fact, they built up one of the largest opium markets in the world. A lot of this opium was reaching the U.S. in the form of heroin. So how did the KMT justify this? Well, there's a famous quote by that top KMT commander and CIA ally, General Tuan, Danita's grandfather. So I'll let her tell it. Basically, he said, to fight the evil of communism, you need guns. Guns cost money. And the only source of money in these hills is opium. Only they never took back China. And most of the drug money, it went to traffickers in Hong Kong and America. Anyway, Myanmar wasn't happy about CIA-backed rebels on their soil. So they bombed them in huge battles, like this one, depicted in a 1990 Taiwanese movie, A Home Too Far. By the early 60s, these KMT fighters get pushed all the way down to Thailand, to this mountaintop, called Masalong. It was a very remote hiding place. And they brought the drug trade with them. According to a CIA report in 1971, this place was home to one of Asia's biggest heroin refineries. But that didn't last, because in the 80s, Thailand said, look, you can stay, but no more opium. Maybe start planting and selling something else, they said.
And pour into your cup.
Like tea. We're back at Yi's house. They've turned the front part into a tea shop. No tigers or machine guns or CIA agents here.
That's why I feel like appreciation. I appreciate everything. Yeah.
These days, this place has nothing to hide. And the young generation, they say the village is almost like accidentally hip. This place is magical, Danita says. We're in the Golden Triangle. There was opium, heroin, danger, and yet now everyone is welcome to come. And it really is kind of hip. Instagrammable views? Check. Niche cuisine for food nerds? Check. The food here is Yunnanese from southwestern China, but they also use Thai spices. In the market, you'll see folks chopping pork to make sausage and pickling veggies, rebel comfort food. Good to have in the jungle when you're on the run. And in Yi's kitchen, I find them frying up this white stump-like thing. It's a bamboo stalk, the root, fried with garlic, and it's great, especially when paired with oolong tea. Pairing the perfect tea with the right food, this is Yi's thing now. She calls herself
tea sommelier. Oolong tea is good with something is oily.
A tea sommelier. Like I said, hip. Yi and Danita, they both have hotels on their tea plantations. And up the hill, there's another little guest house, painted yellow, with a kindly grandfather always sitting out front. That's Songbun, the former rebel fighter. He's also running a small hotel. These days, everyone is welcome here, he says, even if you're visiting from communist-run China. For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Maesalong, Thailand.
And that's it from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.